Chapter 3. A clarification. All of the women were released, except one. She was somewhere in the middle of the line. Like the other women, she was looking back into the living room rather than out the open door, looking back to the floor on which she'd slept like it hadn't been a night, but several years. She was looking back at the men who wouldn't be coming outside, none of whom she actually knew, except the Japanese gentleman whose party this had been. And she certainly didn't know him, but he had been helpful with her accompanist, and for that she searched him out and smiled at him. The men shifted from foot to foot in their pack, all of them sad-eyed and nervous from the far side of the room. Mr. Hosokawa returned her smile, a small dignified acknowledgement, and bowed his head. With the exception of Mr. Hosokawa, the men were not thinking about Roxanne Koss then. They had forgotten her, and the dizzying heights of her arias. They were watching their wives file out into the bright afternoon, knowing it was a probability that they would never see them again. The love they felt rose up into their throats and blocked the air. There went Edith Thibault, the vice president's wife, the beautiful Esmeralda. Roxanne Koss was very nearly at the door, perhaps half a dozen women away, when General Hector stepped forward and took her arm. It was not a particularly aggressive gesture. He might have only been trying to escort her someplace. Perhaps he had wanted her at the front of the line. "Espera," he said, and pointed over to the wall where she should stand alone near a large Matisse painting of pears and peaches in a bowl. It was one of only two works by Matisse in the entire country, and it had been borrowed from the art museum for the party. Roxanne, confused, looked at that moment to the translator. "Wait," Gen said softly in English, trying to make the one word sound as benign as possible. Wait, after all, did not mean that she would never go, only that her leaving would be delayed. She took the word in, thought about it for a moment. She still doubted that's what he had meant, even when she heard it in English. As a child, she had waited. She had waited at school in line for auditions. But the truth was that in the last several years, no one had asked her to wait at all. People waited for her. She did not wait. And all of this, the birthday party, the ridiculous country, the guns, the danger, the waiting involved in all of it was a mockery. She pulled her arm back sharply, and the jolt caused the general's glasses to slip from his nose. "Look," she said to General Hector, no longer willing to tolerate his hand on her skin. "Enough is enough." Gen opened his mouth to translate and then thought better of it. Besides, she was still speaking. "I came here to do a job, to sing for a party, and I did that. I was told to sleep on the floor with all of these people you have some reason to keep, and I did that too. But now it's over." She pointed towards the chair where her accompanist sat hunched over. "He's sick. I have to be with him," she said, though it came off as the least convincing of her arguments. Slumped forward in his chair, his arms hanging from his sides like flags on an especially windless day, the accompanist looked more dead than sick. He did not raise his head when she spoke. The line had stopped moving. Even the women who were free to go now stopped to watch her, regardless of whether or not they had any idea of what she was saying. It was in this moment of uncertainty, the inevitable pause that comes before the translation, that Roxanne Koss saw the moment of her exit. She made a clean move towards the front door, which was open, waiting. General Hector reached up to catch her and, missing her arm, took her firmly by the hair. Such hair made a woman an easy target. It was like being attached to several long, soft ropes. Three things happened in close succession. First, Roxanne Koss, lyric soprano, made a clear, high-pitched sound that came from what appeared to be some combination of surprise and actual pain as the tug caused her neck to snap backwards. Second, every guest invited to the party, with the exception of her accompanist, stepped forward, making it clear that this was the moment for insurrection. Third, every terrorist, ranging from the ages of 14 to 41, cocked the weapon he had been holding, and the great metallic click stilled them all, like a film spliced into one single frame. And there the room waited, time suspended. until Roxanne Coss, without so much as smoothing her dress or touching her hair, turned to go and stand beside a painting that was, in all honesty, a minor work. After that, the generals began arguing quietly among themselves, and even the foot soldiers, the little bandits, were leaning in trying to hear. Their voices blurred together. The word woman was heard, and then the words never and agreement, and then one of them said in a voice that was low and confused, "She could sing." With their heads together, there was no telling who said it. It might well have been all of them. All of us. There were worse reasons to keep a person hostage. You keep someone always for what he or she is worth to you, for what you can trade her for, money or freedom, or somebody else you want more. Any person can be a kind of trading chip when you find a way to hold her. So to hold someone for song, because the thing longed for was the sound of her voice, wasn't it all the same? The terrorists, having no chance to get what they came for, decided to take something else instead. Something that they never in their lives knew that they wanted, until they crouched in the low, dark shaft of the air-conditioning vents. Opera. They decided to take that very thing for which Mr. Hosokawa lived. Roxanne waited alone against the wall near the bright, tumbling fruit, and cried from frustration. The generals began to raise their voices while the rest of the women and then the servants filed out. The men glowered and the young terrorists kept their weapons raised. The accompanist, who had momentarily fallen asleep in his chair, roused himself enough to stand and walked out of the room with the help of the kitchen staff, never having realized that his companion was now behind him.
"This is better," General Benjamin said, walking a wide circle on the floor that had previously been covered in hostages. "Now a man can breathe."
From inside they could hear the extraneous hostages being met with great applause and celebration, the bright pop of camera flashes raised up over the other side of the garden wall. In the midst of the confusion, the accompanist walked right back in the front door, which no one had bothered to lock. He threw it open with such force that it slammed back against the wall, the doorknob leaving a mark in the wood. They would have shot him, but they knew him.
"Roxanne Coss is not outside," he said in Swedish. His voice was thick, his consonants catching between his teeth. "She is not outside."
So slurred was the accompanist's speech that it took even Gan a minute to recognize the language. The Swedish he knew was mostly from Bergman films. He had learned it as a college student, matching the subtitles to the sounds. In Swedish, he could only converse on the darkest of subjects.
"She's here," Gen said.
The accompanist's health seemed temporarily revived by his fury, and for a moment the blood rushed back into his gray cheeks.
"All women are released."
He shook his hands in the air as if he were trying to rush crows from a cornfield. His quickly bluing lips were bright with the foam of his spit. Gen relayed the information in Spanish.
"Christoph, here," Roxanne said, and gave a small wave as if they had only been briefly separated at a party.
"Take me instead,"
the accompanist howled, his knees swaying dangerously towards another buckle. It was a delightfully old-fashioned offer. Though every person in the room knew that no one wanted him and everyone wanted her.
"Put him outside," General Alfredo said.
Two of the boys stepped forward, but the accompanist, who no one thought was capable of escape in his state of rapid and mysterious deterioration, darted past them and sat down hard on the floor beside Roxanne Coss. One of the boys pointed his gun towards the center of his big blonde head.
"Don't shoot her accidentally,"
General Alfredo said.
"What is he saying?"
Roxanne Coss wailed. Reluctantly, Gen told her. Accidentally. That was how people got shot at these things. No real malice, just a bullet a few inches out of place. Roxanne Coss cursed every last person in the room as she held her breath. To die because an underskilled terrorist had poor aim was hardly how she had meant to go. The accompanist's breathing was insanely rapid and thin. He closed his eyes and put his head against her leg. His final burst of passion had been enough for him. Just that quickly, he was asleep.
For the sake of God, said General Benjamin, making one of the largest mistakes in a takeover that had been nothing but a series of mistakes. Just leave him there.
As soon as the words were spoken, the accompanist fell forward and vomited up a mouthful of pale yellow foam. Roxanne was trying to straighten his legs out again, this time with no one to help her.
At least drag him back outside, she said viciously. Can't you see there's something wrong with him?
Anyone could see there was something terribly, terribly wrong with him. His skin was wet and cold, the color of the inner flesh of fish, gone bad. Gen put in the request but was ignored.
No president. One opera singer, General Benjamin said. Is a rotten exchange, if you ask me. She's worth more with the piano player, General Alfredo said. You couldn't get a dollar for him. We keep her,
General Hector said quietly, and the subject of opera singers was closed. Though Hector was the least likely to speak, all of the soldiers were most afraid of him. Even the other two generals exercised caution. All of the hostages, even Gen, were on the other side of the room from where Roxanne and her accompanist were pressed against the wall. Father Arguedas said a prayer quietly, and then went to help her. When General Benjamin told him to return to his side of the room, he smiled and nodded, as if the general was making a little joke, and in that sense was not committing a sin. The priest was amazed by the rushing of his heart, by the fear that swept through his legs and made them weak. It was not a fear of being shot, of course. He did not believe they would shoot him. And if they did, well, that would be that. The fear came from the smell of the little bell-shaped lilies and the warm yellow light of her hair. Not since he was 14, the year he gave his heart to Christ and put all of those worries behind him, had such things moved him. And why did he feel, in the midst of all this fear and confusion, in the mortal danger of so many lives, the wild giddiness of good luck? What unimaginable good luck! That he had been befriended by Anna Loya, cousin of the vice president's wife, that she had made such an extravagant request on his behalf, that the request had been graciously granted, so that he was allowed to stand in the very back of the room to hear, for the first time in his life, the living opera, and not just sung, but sung by Roxanne Koss, who was by anyone's account the greatest soprano of our time. That she would have come to such a country to begin with would have been enough. The honor he would have felt, lying on his single cot in the basement of the rectory, just knowing that she was for one night in the same city in which he lived, would have been a miraculous gift. But that he had been allowed to see her, and then, by fate, which may well portend awful things, but was still, as was all fate, God's will, his wish. He was here now, coming forward to help her with the cumbersome arrangement of her accompanist's gangly limbs, coming close enough to smell the lilies and see her smooth white skin disappearing into the neck of her pistachio-colored gown. He could see that a few of her hairpins remained in place on the crown of her head so that her hair did not fall in her eyes. What a gift. He could not think of it otherwise. Because he believed that such a voice must come from God, then it was God's love he was standing next to now, and the trembling in his chest, his shaking hands, that was only fitting. How could his heart not be filled with love to be so close to God? She smiled at him, a smile that was kind, but utterly in keeping with the circumstances at hand.
Do you know why they're detaining me? She whispered.
At the sound of her voice, he felt his first wave of disappointment. Not in her, never, but in himself. English. Everyone said it would be important to learn English. What was it the tourists said? Have a nice way? But what if that was an inappropriate response? What if it was in some way hurtful? It could be asking for something, camera film or directions or money. He prayed. Finally, sadly, he said the only word he was sure of.
English.
Ah, she said, nodding in sympathy and turning her attention back to her work. When they had settled the accompanist so that he at least appeared comfortable, Father Arguedas took his own handkerchief and wiped the pale sheen of vomit away. He would in no way pretend to have any real medical knowledge, but Certainly he spent a great deal of time visiting the sick, and the sacrament he had most often performed was viaticum. And given those two experiences, he had to say that this man who had played the piano so beautifully looked closer to viaticum than he did to the anointing of the sick.
"Catholic?"
he asked Roxanne Koss, touching the accompanist's chest. She had no idea whether or not the man who played the piano for her had a relationship with God, much less what church that relationship might be conducted through. She shrugged. At least she could communicate with the priest this much.
"Catholica?"
he said, strictly for his own curiosity, and pointed politely to her.
"Me?"
she said, touching the front of her dress.
"Yes."
Then she nodded.
"Si, Catholica."
Two simple words, but she was proud of herself for answering in Spanish. He smiled at that. As for the accompanist, if he was dying, if he was Catholic, those were two fairly big ifs. But where the matter of the soul's everlasting rest was concerned, it was better to err on the side of caution. If he mistakenly gave last rites to a Jew who then recovered, what harm had he done but taken up a little bit of his time, the time of an unconscious political hostage at that? He patted Roxanne's hand. It was like a child's hand, so pale and soft, rounded on the top. On one finger she wore a dark green stone the size of a quail's egg that was surrounded in a fiery ring of diamonds. Normally, when he saw women wearing rings like that, he wished they would make them contributions to the poor. But today found himself imagining the pleasure of gently sliding such a ring onto her finger. This thought, he was sure, was inappropriate, and he felt a nervous dampness creep across his forehead, and he without a handkerchief. He excused himself to go and speak to the generals.
"That man there," Father Argueda said, lowering his voice, "I believe he is dying."
"He isn't dying," General Alfredo said. "He's trying to get her out. He's pretending to die."
"I don't believe so. The pulse, the color of the skin."
He looked back over his shoulder, past the grand piano and huge bouquets of lilies and roses arranged for a party long since over, to the spot where the accompanist lay on the edge of carpet, like something large and spilled.
"Some things one can't pretend."
"He chose to stay. We put him out the door and he came back. Those are not the actions of a dying man."
General Alfredo turned his head away. He rubbed his hand. 10 years those fingers had been gone, and still they ached as if they were there.
"Go back to where you were told to wait,"
General Benjamin said to the priest. He was enjoying a breath of false relief, seeing half of the people gone, as if half of his problems were solved. He knew it to be false, but he wanted some quiet time in which to enjoy it. The room looked wide open.
"I would like some oil from the kitchen to perform last rites."
"No kitchen," General Benjamin said, wagging his head. He lit a cigarette in order to be rude to the young priest.
He wanted the priest and the accompanist to have left when they were told to leave. People shouldn't be allowed to decide that they wished to remain a hostage. He had very little experience being rude to priests, and he needed the cigarette as a prop. He shook out the match and dropped it on the carpet. He wanted to blow the smoke forward, but could not.
"I can do it without the oil," Father Argueda said.
"No last rites," General Alfredo said. "He isn't dying."
"I was only asking for the oil," the priest said respectfully. "I wasn't asking about the last rites."
Each of the generals meant to stop him, to slap him, to have one of the soldiers march him back in line with a gun in his back, but none felt able to do so. That was either the power of the church or the power of the opera singer leaning over the man they took to be her lover. Father Arguedas returned to Roxanne Koss and her accompanist. She had unbuttoned the top of his shirt and was listening to his chest. Her hair spilled over his neck and shoulders in a way that would have thrilled the accompanist immeasurably if he had been conscious, but she could not wake him. Nor could the priest. Father Arguedas knelt beside him and began the prayer of last rites. Perhaps it was grander when one had the vestments and robes, when there was oil to work with. The beauty of candles. But a simple prayer felt in some ways closer to God. He hoped the accompanist was a Catholic. He hoped that his soul would speed towards the open arms of Christ.
God the Father of mercies, through the death and resurrection of his Son, has reconciled the world to himself and sent the Holy Spirit among us for the forgiveness of sins. Through the ministry of the Church, may God give you pardon and peace. Father Arguedas felt a rush of tenderness for this man, an almost choking bond of love. He had played for her. He had heard her voice day after day and been shaped by it. With great sincerity, he whispered, "I absolve you of your sins," into the chalk-white ear. And truly he did forgive the accompanist for everything he might have done. "In the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit."
"That's right," Roxanne Cross said, taking the cold, damp hand that had worked so tirelessly on her behalf. She didn't know the language, but the rituals of Catholicism were recognizable anywhere. This could not be a good sign.
"Through the holy mysteries of our redemption, may Almighty God release you from all punishments in this life and in the life to come. May he open to you the gates of paradise and welcome you to everlasting joy."
Roxanne Koss looked dazed, as if the hypnotist had swung his watch but had not yet snapped his fingers.
"He was a very good pianist," she said.
She wanted to join in, but frankly no longer remembered the prayers. She added,
"He was punctual."
"Let us ask the Lord to come to our brother with his merciful love and grant him relief through this holy anointing."
Father Arguedas touched his thumb to his tongue because he needed something wet and could think of nothing else. He anointed the accompanist's forehead, saying,
"Through this holy anointing, may the Lord in his love and mercy help you with the grace of the Holy Spirit."
Roxanne could see the nun standing over her as she memorized her prayers. She could see the dark rosewood rosaries hanging from their waists. She could smell the coffee on their breath and a faint odor of perspiration in the fabric of their dresses, Sister Joan and Sister Mary Joseph and Sister Serena. She could remember each of them, but not a single word of prayer.
"Sometimes we ordered sandwiches and coffee after rehearsal," she said,
though the priest could not understand her, and the accompanist no longer heard her voice.
"We talked some then."
He had told her about his childhood. He was from Sweden, or Norway. He talked about how cold it was in the winters, but how he never really noticed, growing up there. His mother wouldn't let him play any sort of ball games because she was so worried about his hands, not after all the money she had spent on piano lessons. Father Arguedas anointed the accompanist's hand, saying,
"May the Lord who frees you from sin save you and raise you up."
Roxanne picked up some of his fine blonde hair and held it over her fingers. It looked anemic. It looked like it belonged to a person who wasn't long for this world. The truth was, she had hated the accompanist a little. For months they had worked together amicably. He knew his music, he played with passion, but never tried to overshadow her. He was quiet and reserved, and she liked that about him. She did not try to draw him out. She never thought about him enough to wonder if she should. Then it was decided that he would come with her on this trip. No sooner had the wheels of the plane lifted up from the tarmac than the accompanist grabbed her hand and told her about the impossible burden of love he had been living with. Didn't she know? All those days of being next to her, of hearing her sing. He leaned into her seat and tried to press his ear against her chest, but she pushed him away. It was like that every minute of the 18-hour flight. It was like that in the limousine to the hotel. He pleaded and wept like a child. He catalogued every outfit she had worn to every rehearsal. Outside the car window, an impenetrable wall of leaves and vines sped past. Where was she going? He crept one finger over to touch her skirt, and she knocked it away with the back of her hand. Roxanne bowed her head and closed her eyes, pressed her hands together with the strands of his hair caught in between.
"A prayer can just be something nice," Sister Joan had said.
Sister Joan was her favorite, young and nearly pretty. She kept chocolate in her desk.
"It isn't always the things you want. It can be the things you appreciate."
Sister Joan would often ask Roxanne to sing for the children before assembly. "O Mary, we crown thee with flowers today, even in the dead of a Chicago winter."
"You always wanted to hear about Chicago. I grew up in Chicago," she whispered. "He wanted to know what it was like to grow up near an opera house, He said now that he was in Italy, he could never leave. He said he couldn't bear those cold northern winters now.
Father Arguedas looked up at her, desperate to know what she was saying. Was it confession? Prayer?
Maybe it was something he ate, she said. There could be a food he was allergic to. Maybe he was sick before we got here.
Certainly, he was not the man she had known. They were all three quiet for a while, the accompanist with his eyes closed, the opera singer and the priest both staring down at those closed eyes. Then something occurred to Roxanne Koss, and without hesitation she reached into his pockets and pulled out his wallet and handkerchief and a roll of mints. She flipped through the wallet and put it down. His passport was there, Sweden. She slipped her hands deep into his pants pockets, at which point Father Arguedas stopped his prayers to watch her. There she found a hypodermic needle, used and capped, and a small glass vial with a rubber top, empty but for a drop or two circling the bottom. Insulin. All out of insulin. They would be back at the hotel by midnight, they had been promised. There was no reason to bring more than one shot along. She scrambled to her feet, the necessary proof in her upturned palms. Father Arguedas raised his head as she rushed to the generals.
Diabetic, she cried, a word that had to be more or less the same in any language.
Those medical terms came off Latin roots, the single tree they should all understand. She turned her head toward the men's wall, where they were all watching, like this was any other night at the opera, and tonight's performance was the tragic death of the accompanist, Il pianoforte triste.
Diabetic, she said to Gen.
Gen, who had wanted to give the priest his chance, came forward now and explained what the generals must, without benefit of translation, have understood. The man was in a diabetic coma, which meant that somewhere out there was the medicine needed to save him if he was still alive. They went over to see, General Benjamin dropping his cigarette into the marble fireplace, which was big enough to hold three good-sized children. In fact, the vice president's own three children had crowded in there together after it had been emptied of ashes and scrubbed down, and pretended to be cooked by witches. Father Arguedas had finished the formal prayer, and now simply knelt beside the accompanist, his hands wrapped together, his head bowed, praying silently that the man would find solace and joy in God's eternal love, now that he was dead. When the priest opened his eyes, he saw that he and the accompanist were no longer alone. Father Arguedas smiled gently at the assembled crowd.
Who can separate us from the love of Christ? He said, by way of explanation.
When Roxanne Koss sank to the floor, it was a lovely sight. The pale green chiffon of her dress billowing out like a canopy of new spring leaves caught in a sweep of April wind. She took in her hands the hand that his mother had been so careful with, the hand she had watched play Schumann Lieder hour after hour without tiring. The hand was cold already, and the colors of his face, which hadn't seemed right for hours, were quickly becoming very wrong, yellow around the eyes, a pale lavender creeping up near his lips. His tie was gone, as were the studs from his shirt front, but he still wore his black tails and white waistcoat. He was still dressed for performance. Never for a minute had she thought he was a bad man. And he had been a brilliant pianist. It was just that he shouldn't have waited until they were sealed up in that plane to tell her how he felt about her. And now that he was dead, she wouldn't even hold that against him. All the men had left their wall and come to the other side of the room, where they stood more or less shoulder to shoulder with the band of terrorists. Every one of them had resented the accompanist, thought he was too lucky for being able to play the piano so well, thought he was too forward, the way he had shielded her from the rest of them. But when he was dead, they felt the loss of him. He had died for her, after all. Even from across the room, in languages they may not have understood, they could follow the story clearly. He had never told her he was a diabetic. He had chosen to stay with her rather than ask for the insulin that could save his life. The poor accompanist, their friend. He was one of them.
Now a man is dead, General Benjamin said, throwing up his hands.
His own illness flared at the thought of it, and the pain was like hot needles sewing together the nerve endings of his face.
It isn't as if men haven't died, General Alfredo answered coolly.
He had nearly died himself more times than he could remember, a bullet in his stomach that nearly killed him. Two fingers shot off not 6 months after that, then last year a bullet passing cleanly through the side of his neck.
We are not here to kill these people, we are here to take the president and to go.
No president,
Alfredo reminded him. General Hector, trusting no one, reached down and pressed his own thin fingers against the dead man's jugular.
Perhaps we should shoot him, put his body outside, let them know who they're dealing with.
Father Arguedas, who had been keeping to his prayers, looked up and stared at the generals pointedly. The idea of shooting their new dead friend made the Spanish-speaking hostages recoil. Those who had not previously known that Roxanne Cos did not speak the language were now sure of it, because she remained in the same position, her head in her hands, her skirt circled out around her, while the generals spoke of desecration. A German named Lothar Falken, who knew just enough Spanish to get the vaguest idea of what was going on, sidled up again in the crowd and asked him to translate.
Tell them it won't work, he said. The wound won't bleed. You could shoot him straight through the head now, and they'd still figure out soon enough that he didn't die of a gunshot wound.
Lothar was the vice president of Hoechst, a pharmaceutical company, and had been a biology major at university many years before. He was feeling especially bad about the death, as insulin represented the vast majority of the company's sales. They were, in fact, Germany's leading manufacturer of the drug. They had it everywhere back at the office, free samples of every variety of insulin just waiting to be given away, refrigerators full of endless clinking glass vials there for the taking. He had come to the party because he felt if Nanse was considering an electronics plant in the host country, he might consider manufacturing there as well. Now he was staring at a man who died wanting insulin. He couldn't save the man's life, but at least he could spare him the indignity of being killed again. Gen related the information, trying to choose words that would make the whole thing sound more gruesome rather than less, as he too did not want to see the poor accompanist shot. General Hector took out his gun and stared thoughtfully down the sight.
That's ridiculous, he said.
Roxanne Cos looked up then.
Who's he going to shoot? She asked Gen.
No one, Gen assured her. She wiped her fingers in a straight line beneath her eyes.
Well, he isn't going to clean his gun. Are they going to start killing us now?
Her voice was tired, practical, as if to say she had a schedule and she needed to know where things stood.
You might as well tell her the truth, the vice president whispered to Gen in Spanish. If anyone can stop this, I would think it would be her.
It should not be Gen's responsibility, deciding what was best for her, what to tell and what not to tell. He did not know her. He did not know how she would take such a thing. But then she grabbed his ankle, in the same way a standing person might have grabbed a wrist in an argument. He looked down at this famous hand touching his pants leg and felt confused.
English, she said.
They're considering shooting him,
Gen confessed. He's dead, she said, in case they had missed the point.
How do you say dead in Spanish?
Dead.
Difunto,
Gen said.
Difunto!
Her voice was sliding up into the higher registers now. She stood up. At some point she had made the mistake of taking off her shoes, and in a room full of men, this small woman seemed especially small. Even the vice president had several inches on her. But when she put her shoulders back and raised her head, it was as if she was willing herself to grow, as if from years of appearing far away on a stage, she had learned how to project not just her voice, but her entire person, and the rage that was in her lifted her up until she seemed to tower over them.
You understand this, she said to the generals. Any bullet that goes into that man goes through me first.
She was feeling very bad about the accompanist. She had demanded that the flight attendant find her another seat, but the flight was full. She had been quite cruel to him on the plane, in an attempt to make him be quiet. She pointed a finger at Gen, who reluctantly told them what she had said. The men who circled them like a gallery approved of this. Such love. He had died for her, she would die for him. You've kept one woman, one American, and the one person that anyone in the world has ever heard of before. And if you kill me, and make no mistake, you will have to. Are you getting all of this? She said to the translator. The very wrath of God will come down on you and your people. Even though Gen translated, a clear and simple word-for-word translation, every person in the room understood what she was saying without him, in the same way they would have understood her singing Puccini in Italian. Take him out of here. Drag him to the front steps if you have to, but you let the people out there. Send him home in one piece. A light perspiration had come up on Roxanne Koss's forehead, making her glow like Joan of Arc before the fire. When she was completely finished, she took a breath, fully reinflating her massive lungs, and then sat down again. Her back was to the general's, and she bent forward to lean her head against the chest of her accompanist. Resting on this still chest, she drew herself back into composure. She was surprised to find his body comforting, and she wondered if it was just that she could like him now that he was dead. Once she felt she was herself again, she kissed him to reinforce her point. His lips were slack and cool above the hard resistance of his teeth. From somewhere in the middle of the crowd, Mr. Hosokawa stepped forward, reached into his pocket, and extended to her his handkerchief, clean and pressed. It was odd, he thought, to have been so reduced, to have so little to offer. And yet she took it as if his handkerchief were the thing she had most been hoping for, and pressed it beneath her eyes.
All of you go back, General Benjamin said, not wanting to watch another touching exchange.
He went and sat down in one of the large wing-backed chairs near the fireplace and lit a cigarette. There was nothing to do. He couldn't strike her the way he should have. Surely there would have been an insurrection in the living room, and he wasn't certain that the younger members of his army would not shoot in her defense. What he didn't understand was why he felt grief for the accompanist. Alfredo was right. It wasn't as if this was the first person to die. Most days, it seemed like half the people he knew were dead. The thing was, the people he knew had been murdered, slaughtered in a host of ways that prevented him from sleeping well at night, and this man, the accompanist, had simply died. Somehow those two things did not seem exactly the same. He thought of his brother in prison. His brother, as good as dead, sitting day after day in a cold, dark hole. He wondered if his brother could stay alive a little while longer, maybe just a day or two, until their demands were met and he could be released. The accompanist's death had worried him. People could simply die if no one got to them in time. He looked up from his cigarette.
Get away from here, he said to the crowd,
and with that they all stepped away. Even Roxanne got up and left her corpse, as she was told. She seemed tired now. He commanded his troops to resume their positions. The guests were to go and sit and wait. Alfredo went to the phone and picked it up hesitantly, as if he wasn't exactly sure what it could do. Warfare should not include cellular phones. It made everything seem less serious. He reached into one of the many pockets of his green fatigue pants and pulled out a business card and dialed Messner. He told him there had been an illness. No, a death. And that they needed to negotiate the retrieval of the body. Without the accompanist, everything was different. One would think the sentence should read, without the extra 117 hostages, everything was different. Or, now that terrorists had said they were not there to kill them, everything seemed different. But that wasn't true. It was the accompanist they felt the loss of. Even all the men who had so recently sent their wives and lovers outside, watched them walk away in the full splendor of their evening dress, they were thinking of the dead man. They had not known him at all. Many assumed he was an American. There they were, steadily producing insulin as a matter of course, while another man died without it, so that he could stay with the woman he loved. Each asked himself if he would have done the same, and each decided the chances were good that he would not. The accompanist embodied a certain recklessness of love that they had not possessed since their youth.
What they did not understand was that Roxanne Koss, who now sat in the corner of one of the large down sofas, weeping quietly into Mr. Hosokawa's handkerchief, had never been in love with her accompanist. That she had hardly known him at all except in a professional capacity, and that when he had tried to express his feelings to her, it turned out to be a disastrous mistake. The kind of love that offers its life so easily, so stupidly, is always the love that is not returned. Simon Thibault would never die in a foolish gesture for Edith. On the contrary, he would take every cowardly recourse available to him to ensure that their lives were spent together. But without all the necessary facts, no one understood what had happened, and all they could think was that the accompanist had been a better, braver man, that he had loved more fully than they were capable of loving. Everything was slack now. The huge arrangements of flowers that were placed around the room were already wilting. The smallest edge of brown trimmed the petals of the white roses. The half-empty glasses of champagne that sat on end tables and sideboards were flat and warm. The young guards were so exhausted that some fell asleep against the wall and slid down to the floor without waking. The guests stayed in the living room, whispering a little but mostly being quiet. They curled into overstuffed chairs and slept. They did not test the patience of their guards. They took cushions off the sofa and stretched out on the floor in a way that was reminiscent of the night before, but much better. They knew they were to stay in the living room, be mostly quiet, avoid sudden moves. No one considered slipping out of the bathroom window when they took themselves to the lavatory unattended, maybe out of some unspoken gentleman's agreement. A certain forced respect had been shown to the body of the accompanist, their accompanist. And now they had to try to live up to the standards he had set. When Messner came in, he asked first to see Roxanne Koss. His lips seemed thinner now, stern, and he thoughtlessly spoke in German. Gen pushed up heavily from his chair and went to tell them what was being said. The generals pointed to the woman on the couch whose face was still pressed into a handkerchief.
"And she will be coming out now," Messner said, not as a question. "The president is coming over,"
General Alfredo said.
"You do expect to let her ride home with the body?"
It was not the Messner they had seen before. The sight of a room full of hostages forced to lie on the floor, the battered vice president, the boys with their weapons, all of that had only made him tired, but he was angry now. Angry with nothing but a small red plus sign strapped over his upper arm to protect himself from a room full of guns. His anger seemed to inspire an extraordinary patience in the generals.
"The dead," Hector explained, "know nothing of who is sitting beside them. You said all women. We came up through the air conditioning vents," General Benjamin said,
and then after a pause he added a descriptive phrase, "like moles."
"I need to know if I can trust you," Messner said.
Gen only wished he could parody the weight of his voice, the way he struck every word like a small mallet against a drum.
"If you tell me something, am I to believe you?" "We set free the servants, the ill, and all of the women but one. Perhaps there is something in this one you're interested in. Perhaps if we had kept another, it wouldn't have mattered so much to you." "Am I to believe you?"
General Benjamin thought about this for a moment. He lifted his hand as if to stroke his cheek, but then thought better of it.
"We are not on the same side." "The Swiss never take sides," Messner said. "We are only on the side of the Swiss."
None of the generals had anything more to say to Messner, who needed no confirmation that the accompanist lying at his feet was indeed dead. The priest had covered the body with a tablecloth, and the tablecloth stayed in place. Messner went out the door without pleasantries and returned an hour later with a helper. They brought in a rolling gurney of the type that comes from an ambulance. It came in covered in boxes and sacks, and when they were unloaded, Messner and his helper lowered the gurney and tried to tug the large man up. They ultimately had to be assisted by several of the younger terrorists. Death had made the body dense, as if every recital performed, each day's never-ending practice, came back in those final moments and balanced like lead bars across his chest. When he was in place and strapped down, his fine hands dangling from beneath the cutwork tablecloth, they took him away. Roxanne Koss turned her head as if to study the couch pillows. Mr. Hosokawa wondered if she was thinking about Brunhilde, if she was wishing for a horse that would take her into the fire after her lover's corpse.
I don't think they should have brought the food in like that,
the vice president said to a stranger sitting beside him, although he was hungry and curious as to what was in the bags.
I think they could have made two separate trips out of respect.
The late afternoon light was slanting through the tall windows of the living room, making heavy gold strokes across the floor. It was a lovely room, Rubain thought. A lovely time of day to be in the room. He very rarely was home before dark, and often he wasn't home at all, out representing the president on one trip or another. The ice in his towel had almost completely melted, and the sleeve of his starched dress shirt was soaked from where the water had trickled steadily down his arm. Still, the cool, wet towel felt good on his swollen face. He wondered where his wife and children would sleep tonight, if the president and his wife would invite them into their home as a matter of good publicity, or if they would go to a guarded room in a hotel. He hoped she would go to her cousin Anna's. At least Anna would comfort her. At least she would make some fun for the children and listen to the girls tell their stories about being kidnapped. They would have to double up in extra beds and sleep on pull-out sofas, but that would be all right. That would be better than the Masuda's chilly guest suite, where certainly Esmeralda would be made to sleep in the servants' quarters. On the other side of the room, near a large bank of windows, Gen and Mr. Hosokawa sat away from the rest of their countrymen. It was a complicated form of politeness, in which the other men would not have joined them unless invited. Even in these uncharted circumstances, the social order stood firm. Mr. Hosokawa was not much in the mood for company.
He was a magnificent accompanist, he said to Gen. I've heard my share of them.
Of all the men in the room, Mr. Hosokawa was the only one who continued to wear his jacket and tie. His suit had somehow remained remarkably uncreased.
Would you like me to tell her?
What about the accompanist? Gen said. Mr. Hosokawa looked to Roxanne Koss, whose face was still turned behind the curtain of her own hair. Even though there were men sitting on the sofa where she sat, she was clearly alone. The priest was near her but not with her. His eyes were closed and his lips shaped small, silent words of prayer.
Oh, I'm sure she knows it.
Then he added doubtfully,
I'm sure everyone has told her.
Gen did not press his point. He waited. It was not his role to advise Mr. Hosokawa. He knew the secret was to wait and let him come to his own conclusions.
If it doesn't appear to be disturbing her, he said, perhaps you could give my condolences. Tell her I thought her accompanist was a brave and talented man.
He looked at Gen directly, something that was uncommon between them.
What if I am responsible for this death? He said. How could that be possible? It was my birthday. They came here for me.
They came here to work? Gen said.
They don't know you.
Mr. Hosokawa, the day after his 53rd birthday, looked suddenly old. He had made a mistake accepting such a gift, and now it seemed to be pulling the years from his life.
Tell her, though. Tell her I am especially grieved.
Gen nodded, stood up, and crossed the room. It was a huge room. Even if you didn't count the grand entry hall on one end and dining room on the other, the living room was cavernous, with three separate areas set up with couches and chairs, living rooms within living rooms. The furniture had been moved aside for the recital, and then had slowly been dragged back into mismatched configurations as the remaining guests made themselves comfortable. If there had been a reception desk, it would have seemed very much like an enormous hotel lobby. If there had been a piano player, Gen thought, but then stopped himself. Roxanne Koss was alone, but not too far away. A young terrorist stood behind her, his rifle held close to his chest. Gen had seen this boy before. He was the one who had held Roxanne Koss's hand when they were first on the floor. Why did he remember it was this one when all the others blurred together? It was something about his face, which was delicate, intelligent somehow, and it set him apart. Gen felt uncomfortable for having noticed this at all. Then the boy raised his eyes from the floor and saw Gen looking. They stared at one another for an instant, and then both just as quickly looked away. There was a strange sensation low in Gen's stomach. It made it easier to speak to Roxanne Koss. She did not frighten him the way this boy did.
"Forgive me,"
he said to the opera singer. He shook the boy from his mind. Never in a lifetime would Gen have come to her on his own. Never would he find the courage to express his own sympathies and remorse, in the same way that Mr. Hosokawa would not have the courage to speak to her, even if his English had been perfect. But together, they moved through the world quite easily. Two small halves of courage making a brave whole.
"Gen,"
she said. She smiled sadly, her eyes still red and damp. She reached up from the couch and took his hand. Of all the people in the room, his was the only name she was sure of, and it gave her comfort to say it aloud.
"Gen, thank you for before, for stopping them."
"I didn't stop anyone," he shook his head. He was surprised to hear his name come out of her mouth, surprised by the way it sounded, surprised by the touch of her hand.
"Well, it would have all been pretty meaningless if you hadn't been there to tell them what I was saying. I would have been just another woman screaming."
"You made things very clear."
"To think they wanted to shoot him."
She let go of his hand. "I am glad," Gen said, but then he stopped, trying to think of what there was to be glad about.
"I am glad that your friend had some peace. I'm sure they will send him home soon."
"Yes,"
she said. Gen and Roxanne each imagined the accompanist going home, as in sitting up in a seat by the window of a plane looking out at the clouds that pooled over the host country.
"My employer, Mr. Hosokawa, asks me to offer you his condolences. He wanted me to tell you that your accompanist was very talented. We were honored to hear him play."
She nodded.
"He's right, you know,"
she said. "Christoph was very good. I don't suppose people notice the accompanist very often. That's kind of him to say, your employer." She raised up her open hand again.
"He gave me his handkerchief."
It was a small white flag crushed into her palm.
"I'm afraid I've ruined it. I don't think he'd want it back now."
"Of course he would want you to have it."
"Say his name again for me."
"Hosokawa."
"Hosokawa,"
she said, nodding.
"It was his birthday."
"Yes. He is feeling very sorry about that as well. He has a great sense of responsibility."
"That it was his birthday?"
"That you and your friend came here to perform for him. He feels that you are trapped here because of him. That perhaps your friend..."
Again Gen stopped. There was no point in being so explicit. From this close, her face looked very young, very much like a girl's, with her clear eyes and long hair. But he knew she was at least 10 years older than he was, somewhere in her late 30s.
"You tell Mr. Hosokawa for me," she said.
She stopped to pin some of her hair back away from her face.
"What the hell? It isn't like I'm so busy I can't tell him myself. Does he not speak English? Well, you'll translate. You're the only one of us around here who has a job now. Are there any languages you don't speak?"
Gen smiled at the very thought of such a thing, the towering list of languages he didn't speak.
"Most of them I don't speak a word of," he said.
He stood up and Roxanne Koss put her hand on his arm to walk across the room as if she might faint. It was a possibility. She had had a very hard day. All around the room the men raised their heads and ended their conversations to watch them, the tall young Japanese translator navigating the wide expanse of living room with the soprano on his arm. How strange and lovely it was to see her hand resting on the top of his sleeve, her pale fingers nearly reaching his wrist. When Mr. Hosokawa, who had been trying to look the other way, realized that Gen was bringing Roxanne Koss to him, he felt a deep blush coming up from the collar of his shirt, and he stood to wait for her arrival.
"Mr. Hosokawa,"
Roxanne said and held out her hand to him.
"Miss Koss,"
he said and bowed. Roxanne took one chair and Mr. Hosokawa took the other. Gen pulled up a third, smaller chair and waited.
Gen has told me you feel in some way responsible for this, she said.
Mr. Hosokawa nodded. He spoke to her with great honesty, the kind two people use after a lifetime of knowing one another. But what was a lifetime? This afternoon? This evening? The kidnappers had reset the clocks and no one knew a thing about time anymore. Better this once to be inappropriate and honest as the burden of his guilt was tightening a string around his throat. He told her he had declined many invitations from the host country, but then agreed to come once they told him she would be there. He told her he had never had any plans of helping this country. He told her he was a great admirer of her work and named the cities he had seen her in. He told her he must be in some part responsible for the death of her accompanist.
No, she said. No, I sing in so many places. It's rare that I would sing for a private party like this. To tell you the truth, most people don't have the money, but I've done it before. I didn't come here for your birthday. With all respect, I didn't even remember whose birthday it was. Besides, from what I understand, these people didn't even want you. They wanted the president.
But I was the one who set this thing in motion, Mr. Hosokawa said.
Or did I, she said. I thought about declining. I declined several times until they came up with more money.
She leaned forward, and when she did, Gen and Mr. Hosokawa ducked their heads down as well.
Don't get me wrong. I am very capable of blame. This is an event ripe for blame if ever I saw one. I just don't blame you.
The members of LFDMS could have opened all the doors at that moment, thrown down their guns and told everyone to go, and Mr. Hosokawa would not have experienced any greater sense of relief than the one he had knowing Roxanne Koss forgave him. Several of the foot soldiers came around with the bags that Messner had brought in on the accompanist's gurney and distributed sandwiches and cans of soda, wrapped slices of dark cake and bottled water. If nothing else, the food seemed to be in great abundance, and when they took one sandwich each, the boy shook the bag at them, urging them wordlessly to reach in for more. Or maybe there was simply more for them because they were sitting with Roxanne Koss.
It looks like I'll stay for supper, she said, unwrapping the white paper like a present.
Inside the heavy slabs of bread there was a piece of meat, orangish red with sauce or watery peppers. Its juice dripped into the paper, which she spread across her lap. The two men waited for her to begin, but they didn't have to wait for long. She ate like she was starving.
There are people who would like to have a picture of this, she said, lifting up the sandwich. I'm very particular about my food.
We make exceptions in extraordinary times, Mr. Hosokawa said, and Gen translated.
He was pleased to see her eating, pleased that her grief had not overwhelmed her in any way that could endanger her health. For Gen, the oily piece of meat, which animal, inside stained bread made him stop and consider exactly how hungry he was. He was hungry. He turned his head away from Roxanne Koss and Mr. Hosokawa, afraid of the orange grease on his lips. But before he had the chance to eat even half of his sandwich, one of the boys wearing a green baseball cap came for him. They were just starting to become distinguishable, these boys. This one had a cap with a photo button of Che Guevara on it. Another wore a knife on his chest. One more had a cheap scapula of the Sacred Heart tied high up on his throat with a string. Some of the boys were very big or very small. A few had a handful of whiskers sprouting on their chins. Others had acne. The boy that Gen had noticed with Roxanne had a face like a fine-boned Madonna. The boy that came for him now told Gen in a Spanish so rudimentary that it was a struggle to understand that the generals would see him now. Forgive me, he said in English and Japanese, wrapping up what was left of his meal and putting it discreetly beneath a chair, in hopes it would still be there when he returned. He had especially wanted the cake. General Hector used a pencil to take notes on a yellow tablet. He was extremely meticulous about his writing. Name? General Alfredo asked a man sitting on a red ottoman near the fireplace.
Oscar Mendoza.
The man took his handkerchief out of his pocket and wiped his mouth. He was finishing off a piece of cake.
Any identification?
Mr. Mendoza pulled out his wallet, found a driver's license, a credit card, pictures of his five daughters. General Hector copied down the information. He wrote down his address. General Benjamin picked up the pictures and studied them.
Occupation? He said. Contractor.
Mr. Mendoza did not like them having his address. He lived only 5 miles from here. He had planned on bidding to build the factory that he had been told Mr. Hosokawa had come to his country to develop. Instead, he had slept on a floor, said goodbye to his wife and his grand string of girls for who knew how long, and had to consider the possibility that he might be shot.
Your health?
Mr. Mendoza shrugged.
Good enough, I would think. I'm here. But do you know?
General Benjamin said, trying to remember the tone that the doctor had taken with him when he had gone to the city years before to see about his shingles.
Do you have any conditions?
Mr. Mendoza looked as if he were being asked about the internal workings of his wristwatch.
I wouldn't know.
Gen came along behind them and waited while they asked a few more questions, all of them remarkable only in what unhelpful answers they engendered. They were trying to get rid of more hostages. They were trying to discern who else might be dying. The death of the accompanist had made them nervous. The crowd outside, which had quieted for a while, had begun to bellow again once they saw the body tucked inside its white tablecloth. Murder, murder, they chanted. From the street there came a constant barrage of bullhorned messages and demands. The phone rang and rang and rang with would-be negotiators. Soon all of the terrorists were going to have to be allowed to sleep. The generals were bickering in some shorthand nonsense that Gen couldn't follow. General Hector stopped the argument by taking out his pistol and shooting the clock on the mantel. There were too many people to watch, even with the crowd cut in half. They went from man to man, asking, printing down the answers and names. Gen served in the cases where Spanish was not understood. It was the foreigners they placed their hopes on anyway. Foreign governments willing to pay foreign ransoms. The generals were having to rethink their failed mission. If they couldn't get the president, then there should still be something in it for their troubles. They planned to talk to every hostage in the room, to assess and rank them, to see who would be most beneficial in getting comrades released from high-altitude prisons, for getting money for the cause. But the polling process lacked science. The guests played down their own importance when questioned.
No, I don't run the company, not exactly. I'm only one member on a board of many. This diplomatic post is not as it seems. It was arranged by my brother-in-law.
No one was quite willing to lie, but they tugged down the edges of the truth. The note-taking made them nervous.
All of this information will be checked by our people on the outside, Alfredo said again and again, and Gen translated it into French and German, Greek and Portuguese, each time careful to say their people outside.
Something a translator should never do.
In the middle of an interview with a Dane who was thought to be a potential backer for the non-existent Nansei project, General Benjamin, the upper right portion of his face in flames, turned to Gen.
How did you get to be so smart?
He said in an accusatory tone, as if there was a secret cache of intelligence hidden somewhere in the house that Gen was hoarding all for himself. Gen felt tired, not smart. He felt hungry. Sleep was singing him lullabies. He longed for what was left of his sandwich.
Sir,
he said. He could see Mr. Hosokawa and Roxanne Koss sitting quietly together, unable to speak because their translator was busy with the terrorists' footwork.
Where did you learn so many languages?
Gen had no interest in telling his story. Was his sandwich still beneath the chair? The cake? He was wondering whether or not they would qualify for release, and feeling a sad resignation in the knowledge they would not.
University,
he said simply, and turned his eyes back to the man they were questioning. When they made their lists of those to keep and those to send away, Gen should have been on the top of the list to go. He was worth no money, he had no leverage. He was as much an employee, a working man, as the ones who had fine-sliced the onions for dinner. But when the lists were drawn up, his name did not appear anywhere.
He was somehow beneath their thought altogether. Not that he would have gone without Mr. Hosokawa. He would have chosen to stay like that young priest. But everyone likes to be asked. Once the interviews were completed, and the final decisions were made, it was late in the evening. All around the room, lamps were clicked on. Gen was given the task of making copies of the lists. He had somehow become the secretary to the whole event. In the end, counting the translator, he added his own name, it was decided that 39 hostages would be kept. The final number was 40 because Father Arguedas again refused to leave. With 15 soldiers and 3 generals, it gave them very nearly the 2 hostages for every 1 captor ratio that they had decided upon as being reasonable. Considering that the original plan was for 18 terrorists to take 1 president, the recalculation felt to be as much as they could reasonably handle. What they wanted, what would have been best, would be to tease out the release of the extras, to keep them all for another week, and then let them dribble out, a few here and there in exchange for demands that were met. But the terrorists were tired, the hostages had needs and complaints, they took on the weight of a room full of restless children all needing to be shushed and petted and entertained. They wanted them gone. The vice president could not help himself. He was picking up glasses and putting them on a large silver tray he knew the maid kept in the sideboard in the dining room. When he went to the kitchen, he was followed but not stopped, and he took a minute to rest his cheek against the freezer door. He came back with a dark green plastic garbage bag and began to pick up the wrappers from the sandwiches. There were no crusts of bread left in the papers, only small pools of orange oil. They had all been hungry. He picked up the soda cans from the tables and rugs, even though the tables and rugs did not technically belong to him. He had been happy in this house. It had always been such a bright place when he came home, his children laughing, running down the hallways with their friends, the pretty Indian maids who waxed the floors down on their hands and knees, despite the presence of an electric polisher in the broom closet, the smell of his wife's perfume as she sat at the dressing table brushing her hair. It was his home. He had to make some attempt to put it back towards the familiar so as to keep things bearable.
"Are you comfortable?"
he would say to his guests as he swept some tender crumbs into the palm of his hand.
"Are you holding up all right?"
He wanted to nose their shoes under the sofa. He wanted to drag the blue silk chair down to the other end of the room where it belonged, but decorum prohibited that. He made another trip to the kitchen for a wet cloth, hoping to blot up something that looked like grape juice out of the tight knots of the souvenir rug. At the far end of the room, he saw the opera singer sitting with the Japanese man whose birthday was yesterday. Funny, but with the pain in his head now, he could think of neither of their names. They were leaning towards one another, and from time to time, she would laugh, and then he would nod happily. Was it her husband who had just died? The Japanese man would hum something, and she would listen and nod, and then in a very quiet voice she would sing it back to him. What a sweet sound. Over the constant ruckus of the messages being boomed in through the window, it was hard to make out what it was she was singing. He could only hear the notes, the clear resonance of her voice. Like when he was a boy and would run down the hill past the convent, how he could hear just a moment of the nuns singing, and how it was better that way, to fly past it, rather than to stop and wait and listen. Running, the music flew into him, became the wind that pushed back his hair and the slap of his own feet on the pavement. Hearing her sing now, softly, as he sponged at the carpet, was like that. It was like hearing one bird answer another when you can only hear the reply and not the plaintive original call. When Messner was called again, he came quickly. Ruben Iglesias, vice president, houseboy, was sent to the door to let him in. Poor Messner looked more exhausted, more sunburned as the day went on. How long were these days? Had it been today that the accompanist had died? Had it only been last night that their clothes were fresh and they ate the little chops and listened to the aria of Dvorak? Or was Dvorak something they drank in small glasses after dinner? Had it been so recently that the room was still full of women and the sweet chiffon of their gowns, their jewelry and jeweled hair combs and tiny satin evening bags fashioned to look like peonies? Had it been just yesterday that the house was cleaned,
The window panes and window sills, the sheer curtains and heavy drapes washed and rehung, everything in immaculate order because the president and the famous Mr. Hosokawa, who might want to build a factory in their country, were coming to dinner. It was then that it struck the vice president for the first time. Why had Masuda asked him to have the party at his house? If this birthday was so important, why not the presidential palace? Why, if not because he knew all along that he had no intention of coming?
I think you're getting an infection, Mesner said,
and touched the tips of his pale fingers to Ruben's burning forehead. He flipped open his cellular phone and made a request for antibiotics in a combination of English and Spanish.
I don't know what kind, he said. Whatever they give to people with smashed-up faces.
He put his hand over the bottom of the phone and said to Ruben,
Any, he turned again, what is the word, allergies?
Allergia. Ruben shook his tender head.
Peanuts.
What is he calling about?
General Benjamin said again. Gen told him it was for medication for the vice president.
No medication. I haven't given authorization for any medication, General Alfredo said.
What did this vice president know about infection? The bullet in his stomach. Now that was an infection to talk about.
Certainly not insulin,
Messner said, flipping shut his phone. Alfredo appeared not to hear him. He was shuffling his papers.
Here are the lists. This is who we are keeping, this is who we are letting go.
He put the yellow tablet pages on the table in front of Messner.
These are our demands. They've been updated. There will be no more releases until the demands are completely and fully met. We have been, as you say, very reasonable. Now is the time for the government to be reasonable. I'll tell them that,
Messner said, picking up the papers and folding them into his pocket.
We've been very conscientious in matters of health, Alfredo said.
Gen, suddenly tired, held up his hand for a moment to stop the dialogue, trying to remember the word for concienzudo in English. It came to him.
Anyone needing medical attention will be released.
Including him? Messner tipped his head toward the vice president, who, lost inside the intricate world of his own fever, paid no attention to what was being said.
Him we keep,
General Alfredo said shortly.
We didn't get the president. We have to have something.
There was another list, aside from the demands, money, prisoners released, a plane, transportation to the plane, etc. This was the list that slowed things down, the list of small and immediate needs. The details were not interesting. Certain things had to come in before the excess of hostages could go out. Pillows, 58, blankets, 58, toothbrushes, 58, fruit, mangoes, bananas, cigarettes, 20 cartons, filtered, 20 cartons, unfiltered. Bags of candy, all types, excluding licorice, bars of chocolate, sticks of butter, newspapers, a heating pad. The list went on and on. Inside, they imagined the people on the outside being dispatched on a great scavenger hunt, trying to come up with what was needed in the middle of the night. People would be banging on glass doors, waking up shopkeepers who would be forced to flick on the bright overhead lights. No one wanted to wait until morning and risk the possibility of someone changing his mind. When all the remaining guests were herded together into the dining room to hear the hostage list and release list, there was a great sense of excitement. It was a cakewalk, a game of musical chairs, in which people were randomly rewarded or punished, and they were each one glad to take their chance at the wheel, even those like Mr. Hosokawa and Simon Thibault, who must have known they didn't have a chance of going home, stood with the rest of the men, their hearts beating wildly. The men all thought that Roxanne Koss was sure to be let go now. The idea of keeping one woman would become cumbersome and embarrassing. They would miss her. They were missing her already, but everyone wanted to see her go. They called through the names and told them to go to either the left or the right, and while they didn't say which side was to be released, it was clear enough. One could almost tell from the cut of the tuxedo who would be staying. A great wall of darkness came from those who could now reasonably assume their fate, and it pulled them away from the lucky hilarity of the others. On one side, men deemed less important were going back to their wives, would sleep in the familiar sheets of their own beds, would be greeted by children and dogs, the wet and reckless affection of their unconditional love.
But 39 men and one woman on the other side were just beginning to understand that they were digging in, that this was the house where they lived now, that they had been kidnapped.